Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. It's a damp Monday morning, there's a tube strike, the pageant is over, but Eureka! England have won a test match, the first in 10 attempts since last summer at Headingley against India. So the new regime of Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes have begun with a much needed victory. But Simon, it could have been so different. One ball from Colin de Grandhomme, which dismissed Ben Stokes, but was then adjudged a no ball, and everything would have been different.
Absolutely. And you look at that test match, it was like both sides made their best, absolute best efforts to lose the game. But ultimately, Joe Root's great innings won it. I mean, he was the one that sort of took hold of the game and won the match for England. Fair play to Daryl Mitchell and Tom Blundell as well, because they batted magnificently. And you could argue in those circumstances, perhaps on a pitch like that, with the bowling attacks that we saw in the last 4 days, that, you know, they deserved to win, that partnership deserved them to win them the game. And New Zealand were in such a strong position. They were 244 runs ahead with 6 second innings wickets in hand. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, how do you lose a test match from there? In the same way you could have said it for England, you know, how could they lose a test match when New Zealand were 45 for 7? So, you know, both sides were in sort of strong positions at one stage or other in the game. And ultimately, you know, the fact that, well, there was going to be a result one way or the other, one team had to come out on top. And actually on the final day, it was never really in doubt, was it? Root and Folks played really well. Splendid innings from Root, and Ben Folks supported him to really advance his case as well, because I think he was under a little bit of pressure after what happened in the Caribbean, and the fact that, you know, there's Butler lurking in the background, Johnny Bairstow, could they give him the gloves and bring Brook in at five? It's something we've talked about. Brook in magnificent form, how do they get him in the team? But Ben Folks caught a couple of good catches and played an absolutely vital innings. But I think New Zealand will look back and think, well, that one got away from us. But if England lost, they would have equally said, well, that one got away from us as well. But the magnificence of Root, it's the same old story, isn't it, really? It's not quite Root or bust, but it's been a bit like that for England in recent years.
Yeah. An incredibly brilliant innings. Of course, his first 100 in the fourth innings of a test match, which is extraordinary thing to realise, actually. Out of 2,600, he's never made one in the fourth innings. And I think it just cements in a player's mind their value to the team when they can get home and get the team home and they're not out. You know, it's one of those things that I suppose it's the ultimate realisation of someone's true ability. You know, sometimes sports psychologists divide up players into different categories, and they talk about players who can deliver under intense pressure or circumstance. And for someone like Sachin Tendulkar, for instance, made very few hundreds of those many hundreds that he made in Test cricket. He made very few in the fourth innings. One, of course, famously, was that 100 in Chennai after the terrorist bombs, when he saw India to victory, chasing quite a big target against England, and he sort of commemorated that innings to the Indian nation. Obviously, Joe Root didn't exactly do that this time, but it is that certification of greatness, I think, if you can see your team home with a not-out 100 and almost half the runs as well. Again, we're running out of superlatives for Root, really, aren't we?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been the same old story in the last few years. He's just been batting superbly. What did he say after yesterday's innings? I love batting. And you know, it clearly he does. And he's exceptionally good at it as well. I mean, there was a lot of talk yesterday about, you know, is he England's greatest batter? Ben Stokes said he's one of England's greatest batsmen ever. And Michael Vaughan said, you know, all round, he is England's greatest batter ever. I suppose one thing you would say about that, he's never got an Ashes 100. in Australia. And the Australians might look at that and say, well, hold on a second, how can you say, you know, you've sent down many, many players over the years and quite a few of them have got hundreds in Australia and Joe Root hasn't. I mean, that's one thing that, I mean, he was desperate to correct in the winter. He got close-ish on occasions, but he's not done that. So that's something against him. But you're right. I mean, you know, a fourth innings, a winning 100. It's probably not surprising, actually, that there aren't so many fourth innings hundreds, just statistically, because it's just harder, isn't it? It's harder to score in the fourth innings than it is in the first or the second or the third innings, because you're batting under a lot more pressure. Also, as well, you're not always chasing a big score. So you're not always looking at 300 to win or whatever, because... And, you know, so your chances of scoring 100 in the fourth innings are more limited. You're going to get a chance in the first and second innings of the game in the way you're not in the fourth, because you know, you might be 100 to win or whatever. You're batting first and third in the game. So statistically, it's perhaps not surprising there aren't so many fourth innings hundreds. But I mean, it was a superb innings, total control. Yeah,
total control and finished in a blaze of shots actually as well, but beautifully executed shots. I mean, there's so much poise and balance and almost deftness about his shot making, isn't there? The swivel pull and the lovely caress drive, and I love the way he just guides the ball backward a point, and people will say, well, that's a shot that gets him out. Of course it does sometimes, but the skill, the dexterity with which he steers balls wide of that point fielder on the offside and picks up runs. And it is about the tempo he bats at. Although he batted for, over 5 hours, you know, that 100 came up in 150 balls. Mm. So, you know, he's got a good scoring rate as well, which is so important for England, because, you know, vitally, he was able to maintain that tempo so that England didn't have to face the second new ball chasing that target of 277. I think also, and you pointed it out earlier, Ben Foulkes, a really good innings that. An innings of purpose, and I suppose this is also the Root effect. When you bat with Joe Root, there's two things that happen. One, you see the fluidity, the flow of his play and the way he works the ball around and sees the gaps and penetrates the ball through the infield. But also, you get the strike off him as well. He's not someone who... is a block or a four, and therefore you never get much ball receiving. You know, you get plenty of opportunity to face the bowling with Root as your partner because he's so dynamic. So that undoubtedly benefited Foulkes and rubbed off on him because he played a similar sort of innings. You know, and actually, I just love as well, again, going back to Root, the way he just... manipulates the ball off different bowlers. So against Southie, he was standing largely on leg stump and looking to hit through the offside. Against Jameson, he was shuffling across to the offside occasionally when there was gaps on the leg side because they packed the offside field and just nudging little dinks into the leg side to pick up singles. Not extravagant movements around the crease, just subtle movements just to enable him to manipulate the ball where he needed to.
Jeremy Coney was making the point that he didn't feel New Zealand bowled particularly well, or he didn't think their tactics were particularly good on the final day as well. And it was a tense, potentially tense final day, 61 to win, 5 wickets left. If New Zealand got a wicket, they would have been right in the game, especially if they got one early on. But 5-4 fields, were they bowling one side of the wicket? Probably not. So that, you know, it opened up the ground. And it also meant that, I mean, if they had bowled one side of the wicket and packed one side of the field, okay, you could have tried to manipulate the ball into the leg side, say if you had a 6-3 offside field, could they have dried up the scoring rate so they could have got through to a new ball? I mean, the problem is they couldn't stop England scoring. England just ticked it along, and they never got close to getting that new ball, really, in a sort of damaging time. You know, you needed to take that new ball with sort of 30 left, didn't you? 35 if possible. But England were always ahead with that scoring rate, and Stokes, you know, was able to help them with that with the way he played. And then Root, you're right, it was a quick 100. I mean, generally, he's reasonably fluid, but it was a quick 100 by his standards. I was interested to hear you say that, you know, he that shot he plays outside the off-stump, that back cut. Actually, that was the one ball that nearly got him out, was trying to play that cut shot. It was a bit too close, just went past the inside edge, just past the off-stump, through to the wicketkeeper, actually dropped the ball. Because in Australia, it was his downfall, wasn't it? That ball in the channel outside the off-stump. You know, he tries to open the face, tries to run it away. They got him out many times. And so the Australians will be saying, oh yeah, all well and good, scoring off the Kiwis. They do tend to sort of look down their nose at the Kiwis anyway, because the last time the Kiwis came over, they beat them 3-0. And, you know, they think, hold on, World Test champions, we beat you lot 3-0 in our backyard last time we played you, and we actually thrashed you three times. So, and they'll also, you know, they might also say that about Root as well. You know, okay, it's all very well and good rattling these hundreds out, but come and get one in Ashes series. But, you know.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And it is different playing in Australia. There is more bounce, there is more zip off the pitch in many of those surfaces. So you do have to play a different way. And he will, the next time he goes back to Australia, he will have to adapt to that and look to score slightly different ways, perhaps hit more down the ground rather than that flirty shot, which works so well in lower bouncing conditions. The one where he kind of caresses the ball back with a point, which I was talking about earlier. Very good shot in English conditions when the ball isn't swinging and seaming. In actual fact, it's not such a good shot, as opposed to play from the pavilion end at Lords, where the ball naturally comes back in down the slope, and that's what got him into a little bit of trouble yesterday in that innings. But overall, he's good enough to be able to adapt to conditions. I was quite interested to hear Ben Stokes talking after the game, and a sort of almost talking about the vindication of England's new positivity under McCullum and himself. And of course, it's positivity is something to be admired, but it isn't something to just take on as a universal ploy. I think England still need to think more clearly about when to be positive and when to suck up pressure. It's not all about gung-ho, let's play shots and all that. It's sort of, you know, actually, I was thinking back to the 2005 Ashes and when England came out all guns blazing at Edgbaston after losing at Lords. And it worked there. You know, they got, I think, 400 in a day.
Yeah.
And sort of took the Australians on. And sometimes when you have a team like Australia who are so dominant in that era, you do have to kind of fight fire with fire in a way. But there are lots of teams around now who are more patient that you do have to grind down. And I think England still need to be adaptable. It's no good just saying we're going out to open the batting, Alex Lees and Zach Crawley, and we're going to look to, you know, be positive and take on every opportunity to score. No, it depends on the conditions. It depends who's bowling. It depends on the circumstances. I thought actually they made a reasonable fist of it in the second innings of this game, but I'm still not convinced by that opening partnership that they totally recognise which shots to play when. And that's the key to batting.
Yeah, I mean, there were some sort of traditional pluses as far as England are concerned, weren't there? And Broad and Anderson bowled well, wickets between them in this test match. They dragged England back into the game on the third morning with a new ball. Joe Root, of course, Ben Stokes, with the way he played in the second innings with that half century. So those are sort of traditional pluses. They were the ones we've become used to over the years. I mean, there were sort of a couple of new pluses. We mentioned Ben Folkes and Matthew Potts as well. Wickets in the game, six wickets in the match. I thought he had he looked good, didn't he? He looked the part, you know, straight away. Often it takes a cricketer a while, you know, perhaps to get into a test career. So certainly perhaps a batter, bowler, I suppose you've got more opportunity, haven't you? You can bowl a wayward first over, your nerves settle down. But actually, he was right on it right from the start. So he was a new plus, if you like, and Folkes was a new plus. And it seems a bit unfair in a way to go looking for minuses. But they were in that batting order, you know, apart from in that top six, apart from Root and Ben Stokes, there are still some question marks and still some that, you know, there will be the microscope will be on certain aspects of that. Certainly England top order and Johnny Bairstow as well, just come back from the IPL playing a few extravagant shots. It's interesting actually, Ben Stokes after yesterday saying he actually praised Bairstow, didn't he? He said that's how we want Johnny Bairstow to play. We don't mind, you know, another half an hour of him and, you know, it would have taken the game away from New Zealand because he did come out playing strokes. So anyway, Bairstow's got a couple of hundreds recently. You know, there's no concern there. But it is, I suppose it is going to be that top order that we're going to be looking at for the rest of this series.
Yeah, Bairstow's hundreds that he made recently were, I'd say, a bit more circumspect. And he's still, at the moment, batting as if he's in the IPL. And I just want to see a bit more caution from him. He can still play those big shots, but just get in first. And, you know, you going back to what you said before, that the issue is we're still talking largely about the old guard delivering, aren't we? Anderson and Broad working their way through the New Zealand batting, and Root and Stokes providing the principal partnership, or the match-turning partnership in England's second innings. Yes, folks, obviously partnering with Root there, saw England home, and that was... that was a really excellent sort of move forward for Ben Folkes. But it was Stokes and Root who stabilised the situation and got England into a position where they could potentially win. Obviously, they didn't finish the job. But, we've got to see that next generation, the Crawley, the Pope, new players have got to start delivering, haven't they? And taking on that responsibility.
The other thing that came out from yesterday as well, I mean, there was, you know, Root was quite emotional as he walked off. It looked as though he might have had a tear in his eyes. He walked off and the crowd were cheering. The other thing to say as well is the extended applause for his 100, which also took him to 10,000 runs. I mean, I don't think I've seen an applause last that long for 100 at Lord's. Everyone standing up and cheering, kept on going and going. Obviously, they came up on the board, 10,000 test match runs. But when... Joe Root came off, there looked to be a sort of bit of a tear in his eye, and he spoke afterwards, didn't he? He said, he talked about the captaincy, and we sort of suspected it, didn't we, that it was sort of wearing him down. Why wouldn't it wear you down when you've been so unsuccessful for so long as a test match team, and you've tried this and that, and, you know, you've taken on the Aussies several times, and it's not worked out for you, you haven't been able to win the series. He said he had an unhealthy relationship with the England captaincy, and after West Indies, he went away and thought about it, and he realised that, you know, he wasn't just leaving it all at the ground, he was taking it home with him, and it was affecting his family. I mean, you'd be surprised if he wasn't taking it home with him, and it wasn't affecting his family, actually, when you do it for that long and you are so unsuccessful. And
no, I've seen England captains. I played with both Mike Brearley and Mike Gatting, and you can see totally, even in those days, how much the captaincy wears a player down. So it's an all-consuming thing. Even when you're playing for your county, which obviously they don't now, but when you're away from the test team, there are phone calls, there are meetings, there's news circulating about certain players. There's always some kind of issue bubbling around that they have to consider. By the way, one interesting thing I discovered was that Ben Stokes wouldn't have taken the captaincy on if Root had been sacked. He waited until Root actually resigned and realised he couldn't do it anymore, and then accepted the offer of the captaincy to replace him. But because they're so close, they're really good friends, Stokes and Root, and Ben never wanted to be the person who was sort of preferred to Root. He wanted to wait until Root had had enough, and then he could take on the offer of the captaincy. But he never wanted it to be a sort of rivalry situation or a pressurising Root in any way. He didn't want to see Root sacked and then him being sort of promoted to the captaincy. And the word is, if Root had been sacked and Stokes had been approached, he would have rejected the offer of the captaincy. It was quite a kind of careful protocol required there to, I suppose, induce Root to resign or leave him to make his own decision, and then at some later point approach Stokes with the offer of the captaincy. And obviously it's worked out well, and they've handled it extremely well, because there's no hard feelings from either party. And England have started with a win.
I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? So what would they have done if someone had to sack Root sooner or later? And if the new coach came and said, well, actually, we do need a change here. So Ben Stokes wouldn't have taken the job. Where would they have turned? Because, I mean, everyone has said, isn't it, that Ben Stokes was the obvious and almost only choice. So they'd have had quite a big problem then if that had been the case.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been probably an interim captain, I guess. Perhaps a Stuart Broad for a little while to see how it went. And then, at some later point, perhaps Stokes would have felt that he could take it on.
Well, there we go. What about New Zealand, Yoz? We talked a lot about England. New Zealand had winning chances in the game. England had winning chances. Normally in a test match, a team these days, I mean, it happened a bit more in the past, I think, where you get games that went to and fro. Often these days, a team takes control of the game and it's very hard to shake that control. Okay, you can loosen it a bit, but generally speaking, they go on and maintain their grip of the match. This one was, I mean, I think a remarkable game in a way. And sometimes at stages, it felt like a sort of quite a low-grade game. I mean, it's certainly in the first two innings of the match and sort of in parts of the second innings of both sides as well. But it was up and down. Both sides had more than one winning position, I would say, in the game and squandered them. And then eventually, Root was able to give England their victory. What about New Zealand? We sense they're not quite the side they were this time last year when they won the World Test Championship. I mean, one thing we pointed out before the series started is their team's quite old, a lot of players in their 30s. I mean, that could be good in a way, a lot of experienced players who know their game. Williamson struggling as captain as well a bit, but certainly as a batter. And you look at that batting lineup. It's not a stellar batting lineup, is it? The New Zealand lineup is solid. There's, some good players in there, but you don't think, oh, I'm going to watch him play today. But clearly, their runs in that lineup, and they've made the most of themselves. Brilliantly, brilliant to win the World Test Championship a year ago. What sort of problems do you think they have, or do you think they could actually just come back and win the series? Because although England won this game, there's enough, if you want of a better word, enough flakiness in the England lineup for New Zealand to exploit in the next two games.
Well, there is that's true. I think that the problems New Zealand have are firstly lack of preparation. That it's so difficult to play a test match having had very little red ball experience in that country. It's really difficult. And you come up against the masters of seamen swing like Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad, your likelihood of success is massively undermined. And that's going to be the case at the second test in Trent Bridge, where, of course, Anderson is, that's his favourite ground. He wants to roll that pitch up and carry it around with him, really. It swings around as well, of course. So I don't see any kind of transformation in New Zealand's batting. What they could do is make better use of their resources. I mean, obviously, they were unlucky. They lost De Grondo and they lost their fifth bowler, which I think was quite important. But they could have made better use of their other bowler, which was Patel, the left-arm spinner. Couldn't believe he only bowled two overs in the second innings. Admittedly, most of those two overs were to Ben Stokes and he hit him for two big sixes. But he never bowled, I think he only bowled one ball at a right-hander and Joe Root did a little paddle sweep for a single. But why he didn't use the spinner more, just with two right-handers in on a fourth day pitch or a late third day pitch. So I don't think necessarily Williamson handled his bowling resources that well. There'll be a couple of changes in the team, clearly, because of De Grondo missing out. But principally, they've got to make more runs. Their top order has to deliver, and that's going to be tough without the preparation that they haven't had. And also, of course, missing Ross Taylor as well in the middle order, who was so much a sort of a trusted, reliable axis around which they could build their innings.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue it both ways, couldn't you? In a way, you could say that New Zealand were, you mentioned at the start, one ball away, one unfortunate moment in that delivery to Ben Stokes away, possibly from winning the game. And then, even then, they might have gone on to win the game if De Grondhomme had stayed on the field. Because what it meant was that there was a big burden on the other bowlers. And Kane Williamson, he didn't go anywhere else. He just went with those three seam bowlers. He almost went to the well too much, perhaps. They bowl a lot of overs. They got tired and they were unable to control England, especially on that third evening when that Root and Folks partnership was beginning to develop. So, a couple of things went against them. You know, we've seen England take wickets off no balls as well. And Ben Stokes did it in the Ashes, didn't he? First test in Brisbane when he had David Warner out off a no ball. It's so desperately frustrating and deflating, I think, for a fielding side. So, yeah, they weren't far away. And actually, we could be sitting here this morning talking a completely different story. It would have needed something special for England to win from 70-odd for five. And on another day, that's what would have happened. But that's sport in a way. There are so many fine margins, aren't there, in so many sports. So you think back to the Champions League final. Everyone said, well played Real Madrid, but the former Chelsea goalkeeper Courtois, I mean, made one amazing save in the second half where it sort of hit his arm. Well, another day that could have just brushed his arm and gone into the top corner. It could have been completely different, a bit like the Bayern Munich Manchester United game in 1999. Bayern played really well and United came back at the end and sort of, it was a slightly freakish sort of victory. And you can argue there were sort of elements of that to England's win, but they still needed to produce that outright quality in that stand between Root and Ben Folkes. So, perhaps all is not lost for New Zealand. There'll be enough to encourage them if things go their way at Trent Bridge. One thing they could do, the fact that Patel didn't bowl very much makes you think, we've talked about this before, haven't we, this idea that some pitches, or are five seamer pitches. People say, you don't need five seamers, it's too many, you don't know when to bowl them all. But actually in this game they'd have loved to have had Neil Wagner during the game, I would have thought, wouldn't you? Or even Matt Henry. Patel didn't bowl. I know why they played Patel, because I think there was a feeling the pitch was dry. And, they won the toss and you think, we've got a spinner to bowl late on the fourth into the fifth day. But, of course, we didn't get that far because the batting in the first innings of both sides was particularly poor. And there was also some good bowling as well. So you can see how it happened to New Zealand. And I can sort of see why Kane Williamson didn't bowl Patel very much, because he just thought, my bankers are my three main quick bowlers. You've got a lot of test wickets and had a great deal of success. So you can sort of see what happened there. But they would have loved that extra pace bowler. What about England as well? I mean, they played a spinner. Parkinson picked up one wicket. Leach out with concussion. Parkinson came in, and Parkinson's now been added for the Trent Bridge Test match. We don't know whether Jack Leach is going to be fit to play. You don't know whether they're necessarily going to. We'll go with Matt Parkinson, see where that takes us. Parkinson didn't have a massive influence on the game either. So both sides picking a spinner early. In early June. At Lords, where traditionally the pace bowlers have held sway. Spinners have had a bit of success, but generally pace bowlers have held sway in recent years. So what do you think New Zealand do? What do you think England do in terms of the spin department?
Well, obviously they've got to bat better. If they're going to use a spinner, they have to bat longer and take the game into a fourth and fifth day. I think England will pick Leach if he's fit. I think in fact that all Parkinson proved to me illustrated why he hasn't got a game so far, really, because I just think he looked innocuous. If it's a raging turner on the fifth day, he might be very handy, but before that I can't see him having much influence on a test match, because he's too slow and he doesn't get enough bounce.
And what would Leach's influence be earlier in the test match? They're just holding
well,
roll,
Leach,
holding
Leach has got control. Leach can give you control, undoubtedly, and he's improving slowly. He's had a fair bit of bowling this summer. He's not a massive turner of the ball either, but he does give you a bit of control, and he's got experience. And actually, he can bat as well. He can hold up an end, which... I looking at Parkinson's first class record of an average of 9 is even lower than Anderson. So I'm not saying that you pick a spinner because he can bat, but it helps if you can at least supply some kind of doggedness at some point down the order. So I think England will pick Leach if he's fit. I hope that New Zealand pick Patel, because I think he's got something. I always love watching left arm spinners bowl. England have got plenty of right handers. If they can bat a bit longer, the New Zealanders, at Trent Bridge, then the spinner will find some assistance. So I would be inclined to keep him, but we'll see, I suppose. It's all about the balance of the side and, I guess, the conditions and what the weather forecast suggests. If it's overcast and a bit kind of clammy at Trent Bridge, for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The seamers are going to do most of
it. Yeah, I had a look at the long-range forecast because you don't quite know what it's going to be like when we get there. But it does look as if it's going to be similar sort of weather, so coolish, some dry weather around, a few showers, a bit of rain around as well for all 5 days, actually. I think the first day is going to be okay, and then after that it's going to be a bit mixed. So whether the spinners will have much influence there, I don't know. It might be best to go with an all-seam attack. Preparation, you talk about New Zealand not having a great deal of preparation. Because one player who did have good preparation, Will Young, at the top of the order, made a pair of ones, and you know he has been playing in county cricket. He made 100 for Northants against Warwickshire. He made 96 against Yorkshire, 63 against Essex. At the Oval, he made 2 and 3 against a decent Surrey side. So you know it can go both ways. So perhaps you know someone like him, he is in the essentially, I suppose, rejigged it a bit. He's sort of Ross Taylor's replacement in a way. They need more from someone like him, someone who has had a lot of preparation. But he was up against that new ball attack of England of Broad and Anderson, which has finished off many top order partnerships, in England and especially at Lords, where the ball does do a bit. I saw a bit of comment about the Lords pitch, saying if this had happened in India, where teams had struggled in the first innings, 130 plays, 140, everyone would be complaining about the pitch. What did you think about the surface at Lords? I mean, is it as much the conditions?
I think it was fine. I think it was complete. I think it was a perfectly good test pitch. It lacked a bit of pace. It wasn't flying through, was it, at any stage, really? I think you just have to look at the quality of the bowling more than anything. I mean, Anderson's first spell on that first morning, 6 overs, 5 maidens, 2 for 4, I think it was. A one scoring shot, a clip through mid-wicket. 2 wickets, both excellent catches by Johnny Bairstow at slip. But that spell just reminded everybody why Anderson has over 600 test wickets, because he is brilliant with the new ball, especially at Lords, somewhere where he can use the slopes to his advantage as well, make the ball move up the slope from the pavilion end, so you don't know what to play and what to leave, can use the slope against the left-handers. Fantastic bowling. I defy anybody to know. I think I heard Alistair Cook saying on commentary he didn't know where he would have scored a run in that first session. So hats off to him again, and actually to Broad too for that second innings spell where he changed the game. He knocked over Daryl Mitchell. Then there was that sort of weird incident with Colin de Grondon getting run out, but it was a good delivery which asked a question, rammed him on the pads, could have been LBW, probably was just missing, and then knocked over Kyle Jameson next ball. Again, you know, both those bowlers conform to type. Anderson, absolutely peerless with the new ball, and Broad on a roll at a stage where the match was in the balance. So, more than the Lord's pitch, I just think you have to celebrate the return of Broad and Anderson.
I don't think it was a bad pitch. I mean, there was a little bit of an even bounce, a few capped low. The ball did a bit, and actually made for really interesting Test cricket. Sometimes I think if you're a top order player in a situation like that, you think, oh, I wouldn't mind a nice flat one, a nice belter somewhere like we've been having in county cricket, and the ball going soft. That would help me out a bit, but you know, as you say, it's tough. And I think the start of the 21st century, Lord's pitches got really flat, didn't they? But of late, the last few years, there's something in it for the bowlers. It does make it fascinating. And I suspect Trent Bridge will be similar with the weather that we are expecting, and the two bowling attacks, the two batting lineups, and you know, generally the overheads and the pitch at Trent Bridge.
The thing is, I would say, you know, I don't know whether the Lord's pitches have changed that much in, say, 15 to 20 years. I think it's more these seam bowlers are now equipped with more skills. They're brilliant at utilising anything. So, obviously, things like the wobble seam delivery, or what Tim Southee uses, the three-quarter delivery ball, where he sort of holds the seam at a slight angle and makes it look like an outswinger and it nipped back the other way. I think bowlers have become this group of players who are sharing ideas or copying things from each other, because more and more close-ups of delivery styles and obviously Hawkeye evidence of what those balls do as well. So that's one thing. Bowlers sharing ideas and borrowing skills from each other. And also the round the wicket to left-handers ploy, which every faster bowler now uses. And they've realised from the statistics and the analysis over time that has cut left-handers' productivity down massively as well. So I just think bowlers are becoming more clever and cleverer at utilising anything in pitches. Whether there's that much more in the pitch itself, I'm not sure. It's just they're very good at finding and maintaining their threat.
Final question, Yoz, before we say goodbye. Have England turned a corner? That slightly tongue-in-cheek.
No, they haven't. It's going to take a long time, as you and I have both been saying. But as losing becomes a habit, so does winning. And there's nothing better than tasting victory and whetting your appetite for more. But there's got to be more contributions from other team members other than the ones that we know are world class.
Well, what it has done, I think, that Test match is sort of whetted our appetite for the summer. I think we were looking forward to it already, you know, with a new era or new personnel in charge of English cricket. England pulling one out of the bag in the end by winning that Test match. It looked extremely unlikely after a couple of days with New Zealand in a dominant position. But all eyes now turn to Trent Bridge on Friday for the second Test match. And we will report back and we'll reflect on the first day's play on Friday evening.
In the meantime, look out for my other podcast, The Barest of Margins, looking at fine margins that have been achieved by athletes in sport through science and technology and innovation. And this week, I've interviewed the nutritionist for the England team, Emma Gardner, talking about what you should eat as a cricketer and what they do eat. And how hard it's been, but how successful it's been to persuade players to adopt a slightly different attitude to their diet. So are those Lord's lunches actually good for you? I'll reveal all later in the week on the Barest of Margins podcast.
Podcast Network.